Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name is Judy Herman, and I'm at the Trafalgar Studios in London with Moses and Nina Raine, because Moses' play Don Quixote, directed by Nina, has transferred for one hell of a lap of honour here from The Old Red Lion, where it enjoyed a fantastic run and brilliant reviews as well. So, both of you, first of all, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I would sort of call this play almost Chekhovian with swear words added, but because it's got that feel, that family feel about it. But it's also sort of Welcome to Russia, which you know a lot about, don't you? Because this is a play set in one tiny room in Moscow, where I couldn't believe how many people were supposed to be coming and going and living and sleeping in this flat. I know you've got family in Moscow. Did you go and visit them? How do they feel about this? Are they relevant? And you've got this wonderful figure, I think he's called Thomas, who is the English boy who's over there staying with them as well. Is it autobiographical? Lots of questions first. I guess that's mostly really for you, isn't it, Moses?
Well, and for Nina, because we've both been to Moscow and we've both spent a certain amount of time there. And also our Russian relatives often come to the UK to see us in our house in Oxford, because basically our great-grandfather Leonid Pasternak, who was a painter, emigrated from Russia to Germany, and then the Nazis came to power and he emigrated from Germany to England and with his two daughters, and one of those two daughters is my grandmother. And so basically the family was split in half. So Boris Pasternak's side of the family and his brother Alexander, they both live in Moscow at the moment. And so we often see each other. And my cousin came over to the UK a couple of summers ago, and I'd started writing. Well, I'd been writing for about 10 years. And she told me loads of stories about living in Moscow. And I just thought, oh, well, it's like Chekhov, but now it's amazing. And it's such a sort of weird place when you go and visit, because it's just like any European country, but slightly backward. It's not quite there. And so when I went with my mum, maybe 3 years ago now, I was really struck by that and wanted to write something.
Nina, having you directed the play, but obviously, as Moses says, you've been out there as well. So tell me about Moscow and you.
Well, I went and visited relatives there maybe two or three times. And so I actually saw this flat. So I had that flat very clearly in my head when I was working on the design with the designer. And I knew exactly... You know, it's not stretching the reality. When I came to stay, the girl, our cousin, moved out of her single bed onto the sofa, and that was perfectly normal to them. And there was this continual flux of people coming in and out of the flat. And there was a lunch when I came where they all drank vodka like it was water, really. I mean, just all these cliches that you find out are true. So I had quite a strong idea and a strong flavour in my mouth, if you like, of what we wanted to recreate. What's interesting to me is that knowing Mo, I know that Mo hasn't sat down and read all of Chekhov's plays. He's seen a couple of them, but that he wrote something Chekhovian not because he wanted to write a Chekhov play, but because he went to Russia and somehow the spirit of what he encountered resulted in a play that has Chekhovian flavours. It really is running through their blood, the Russians.
I agree with Nina that there is something running through their souls. It was captured by Chekhov, and it's very weird how they think of the future. I remember my cousin talking about her destiny rather than her what was going to happen, her plans, and I think that was a really interesting choice of word, because it's destiny sort of implies that it's something that's going to happen to you rather than something that you are going to make happen. And I think in the West, we sort of think of our future more as something that we can cultivate rather than something that's going to be lumbered on us.
So we're saying that the Russians have fatalistic souls, are we?
Yeah, I think that might be the case. Yeah, especially with the ones we know anyway. And it was funny because we had to try and translate that for our actors, you know, because it is quite an alien thing. So, for instance, Amanda Root's character, she fights and fights in the play, but then there are moments where she just, she seems to stoically accept what fate has presented her with, which is a cheating husband that can't be changed by her. And there's a moment at the end of a scene where her daughter asks her, sort of in exasperation, so what are you going to do? Are you going to talk to him? And she says, no, I'll wait, I'll grit my teeth, I'll be patient, you know. And Mo, I remember listening to Amanda delivering that line in rehearsals and thinking, gosh, we have to pitch this quite perfectly, because there's something in that that's not about being weak and it's not about being passive. It's sort of a very Slavic attitude to accept something you're not happy with, but it isn't a weak thing. I was trying to sort of convey this to Amanda that, you know, it's something. Mo, how did you put it?
I think I probably said the thing about destiny and the difference between destiny and future. I think that's how I illustrated it for her, because that's something that we really don't think about. We don't ever think about our destiny. Mm. And we would never translate it as that.
It was interesting, you said something earlier on, a couple of times you said things about flavours and tastes. You could take, I think you said you could taste the room or something like that. I love that idea, you know, that it's in almost four-dimensional, I suppose, if you think of taste as another dimension.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they have a smell, these Moscow flats. I wish we could have sort of sprayed it around, you know. They really do. It's sort of the years of cooking and the way that, you know, in the winter they stick a sort of plastic layer over their windows, and the windows simply aren't opened for the whole of the fierce winter. So all these smells sort of stew away in this flat. It's not disgusting. I'm making it sound sweaty and gross. It's not that. It's just permeates every bit of furniture, and, you know, it's a very... You wouldn't be able to recreate that smell anyway, even if you tried. But I tried to do it with the colours of the set, really, the greens and the dark browns. And, you know, what is lovely, actually, about doing a play in a tiny space is that you can smell things, so that when Ivan peels his orange in one of those final scenes, you see this sort of spray of the zest in the lights, and you can smell it in the back row of the theatre, and I love that.
I was in the back row and I could, yeah. I loved the way that it was fantastically cluttered, but all the clutter, nothing was there just randomly, oh, I think it would look nice to have some plums there. Everything had a purpose, everything played a part, as if you'd cast every stick of furniture and rug and even piece of fruit. So I think that's both of you, isn't it?
And it was authentic as well, so all of the crisp packets, they are direct from Moscow, and all of the newspapers and cigarette packets, and what else is there, washing up powder and cereal. My brother was there, and he bought loads of shopping, emptied it, and then carried back rubbish, effectively. Only it wasn't, it was set dressing. So and then he airmailed, I got a DHL full of rubbish, which I was very pleased to receive.
Our brother Isaac works in fashion, and he was in Moscow for L'Envin, and I think that the people who were, you know, looking after his hotel room would have been completely baffled, because there he was staying in a posh suite, and the bin was full of crisps, sweets, literally emptied out, that, you know, he'd taken the empty packets away. I have to praise the designer as well, because James Turner is just brilliant at having that sort of nose for the right piece of furniture, and Anna Driftmeyer, who helped him source all that stuff. Because it is like casting a play. You've got to cast the right armchair, you've got to cast the right sofa, and he is brilliant at that. And we had, you know, we worked very hard before the play even began, sort of looking at online images of Russian photographs of people in their flats, and we noticed things and we quoted them in the set. So, for instance, there's a Russian kind of disdain for aesthetics, where they go, well, you know, if we want to plug in the toaster just above our dining room table, then that will be where the plug will go, and if it looks ugly, well, so be it. And so they have plugs in very odd places, they have bookshelves in very odd places, they have carpets hanging on the walls. You know, they have all these things that are so Russian. And, you know, I've had plays on that I've written in, for instance, America. And they I remember going to see a play that I wrote, and it was set, you know, in a London house, and yet it looked so American because they had sourced what they thought, oh, well, you know, we just need a rug and we need this and we need that. I don't think they'd ever been to a North London house, you know, not that they're all the same or anything, but they sort of had this idea of what London Bohemia was like, but actually it was really American. And I think you have to, if I could have had my way, we would have actually both gone to Moscow, but we just didn't have the money or the time.
James Turner really took it to like the umpteenth, because for the plug for the toaster, he got a European plug. And then we had loads of trouble changing all of the plugs on things like hair dryers and toasters so that they all matched up. And then he got a proper switch, proper Russian switch.
Light switch.
So he went to great lengths.
I mean, we should stop probably and just... We've said it's about a family in a crowded flat. Should just let's explain us a little bit more about who these people are and what sort of atmosphere they're living in and why. Just set it all up for us. I guess Moses set it up.
Okay, so it's a family, three generations all living in the same flat. And really, the story is of an English guy coming to visit the daughter, and he's sort of romantically minded, and she is not. And very quickly, the story starts segueing, and another story comes in, which is the father is suspected of having an affair, and slowly through the play we work out whether he is or is not having that affair. And so really what the play is about is sort of illustrating Moscow life now and Moscow life 50 years ago under Soviet rule, and how it's changed and how it hasn't changed, and how the past actually lives on for quite a long time. And it doesn't matter if you're not queuing for food, if you have lived in a sort of a police state, you will be slightly, will be sort of, you know, that it lives on. It doesn't just go away in a heartbeat. That's that kind of fear of being followed and of worrying about what you say, and you know, it sort of lives on.
It's like almost like conditioning handed down, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that when I went there, I was really amazed by just the idea of, because I talked to Zhenia, my what he'd be my like second cousin, but he was 80, and him talking to me about living under communist rule. And I spent a sunny afternoon with him and my mum translating. The scene in the play where the grandfather speaks is basically verbatim what I was told. I didn't have to do very much writing, mainly editing it so that it sort of made more sense. And I was sort of shocked, and it was a real driving force, because I wanted to tell that story. I don't think in the West we really understand what it would be like to be spied on. Not really.
Yeah, well, for him, certainly, he's literally haunted by the past, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that that was true of my uncle or cousin. I can't work out what Zhenia is right now. What is he? Is he second? He's mum's cousin.
I think it's to do with cousinage, yeah. But yeah, the important thing is that he was in his 80s when you were having that conversation with him. So, yeah, I mean, the being spied on thing, we talk about it here, but... yeah, the imprinting that happens on people when they've lived through it in other generations. That's the extraordinary thing, you know. I mean, to just go off at a tangent, a friend of mine was saying how her grandparents always used to row at the weekends, and then her mother and father rowed at the weekends, and now she's married and she finds that she's rowing at the weekends, and that there are sort of contortions that can't help but be copied in the generations that follow. And that's true of, you know, the politics that people have lived through, and of their Stoppard would call private contortions as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, in that case, I think that's very clear in the play that it isn't that they have got that paranoia that there might still be the state spying on them because one of the sons is trying to dodge the draft, and it's that bribery thing, he can bribe the doctor. But at the same time, it's almost imprinted that you can go and spy on someone. There's a hell of a lot of, you know, oh, can we get to the laptop? And you used the word, you said he suspected of having an affair. Now, the suspect is a sort of KGB word, isn't it? You know, not they think he might be having an affair. You know, I'm in the right, you know what I mean, and you're in the wrong, and when we are spying on you.
Yeah, suspect, exactly. You know, are you guilty?
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that's the other thing about it, which is that, you know, talk about suspect and all of this. I think that I'm probably as guilty as anyone else of, you know, everybody wants to know what's going on in someone else's life, especially if they are having an affair. You do want to find out what the truth is. And if someone is hiding something from you, there will be a bit of you which will want to sort of rootle out the truth. So there's that going on at the same time. I mean, is, you know, how wrong is it that they want to follow their father to find out whether he's having an affair? I think that he shouldn't really be having the affair.
It's such an interesting situation. I mean, you have cause for, you can be very self-righteous anger or whatever it is. Don't know, not sure, you know, how that would translate. I mean, you've written for television, haven't you? And it's that sort. I'd expect to see it on EastEnders, I must say. And what's the one you wrote for?
We wrote the last ever episode. Very proud to say the last ever episode of Mistresses, which was made by Acos Films and was fantastic fun to write for. I've never ever done anything before or since like that. And if anyone in TV land's listening to me, I would love to do it again. It was like sort of recreating ketchup or something. It was such a strange thing. There were various demands that you needed to hit, various plot challenges that you had to solve, and it was sort of like doing a crossword or something. It was very weird. And I was very lucky because I was doing it with Nina at the same time, so I had someone who was a master of plot, and I came up with ridiculous dialogue that we forced into various contortions. And it was great fun. So yes, it could be described as a sort of EastEnders-esque plot.
Well, that bit of it, anyway. There's more, isn't
that,
there?
That bit of it. But I don't really see anything wrong with that.
No, I wasn't seeing anything wrong with it. And in fact, you know, it's like pure, almost like comedy or dramatic gold that we're talking about Mistresses, because that's what we're talking about. Yeah. Does he have a mistress? But so, Nina, tell me about Mistresses and how that might work for this one for you.
Oh, well, I was actually just thinking, I'll come back to Mistresses in a sec, but I was just thinking this thing of making a judgment on someone. I always think when it comes to the last scene of the play and the grandfather sternly says to Yvonne, the sinning father, you know, where does it end? Gulags, show trials, spying on your own family. And I always hear that word show trial, and I think, well, that's what the family kind of subject Yvonne to. Mm. So I think that morally it's not just saying Yvonne is a baddie who has sinned. The children do become like KGB towards him. So it's the messages are quite, you know, they work both ways round in a way. Mistresses, Mo said ketchup, and it's interesting because, like, you know how Coca-Cola or whatever, there's a very, we're talking about flavours again, but it's a best-selling flavour, isn't it? And we'd write a scene or a draft of a script and they'd say, it sort of sounds rather too much like your own voice. Could you make it a bit more mistressy? And, you know, you can't really. They hire you for your voice, but then on a show like that, you can't actually. You have to iron out that stuff. If your jokes are too quirky or, you know, there were alarm bells for them. And I that was a little bit sad for me. I thought that was a bit of a shame.
I thought that it was such a great challenge to have to come up with the great flavour of ketchup or Diet Coke or peanut butter and work really hard. It's a very strange discipline, and one that you work out kind of quite quickly that you can't, as Nina say, be too quirky. You have to think of very particular lines. Most scenes start with someone hanging up a mobile phone or coming into a room and someone else is there. I mean, and anything that is vaguely quirky, like we tried to write a scene for Joanna Lumley and her daughter, who was played by Sarah Parrish, and we tried to do it so that they were on Skype, and I wrote loads of hilarious jokes about Skype, and that all went out of the window because it's too weird, too laboured. But yeah, no, yeah.
Well, that's still like possibly a useful experience for this one, and you've obviously got Nina there as a check and balance, and obviously hundreds of other things as well, but you have a great comic voice. I mean, it's such a funny play, but it's quite scurrilous, as I said, you know, quite Chekhov with the swear words, and it'd be quite hard to do an extract for radio, I think, in some ways.
It would be absolutely impossible to do any of it on radio, and poor Radio 4. they're missing out. And I had a great deal of fun writing it. I would sit and make myself laugh quite hard, and then say to Nina, is this funny? And she'd go, well, if you do that, you're going to have to do various other things because you can't just do it for the joke. So there's a bit later on in the play where they find a pair of, like, a thong. Mm. And when I originally wrote that, I wrote the gag first, which is a guy finds a thong in his bed, thinks it's his girlfriend's, and then she says it's not hers. And Nina said, well, you're going to have to thread that through the play, otherwise it's just a joke. So I was sort of led by Nina and my sort of comic voice, and I got something really, I think, spectacular out of it. Yeah. But it did make me laugh a lot.
Yeah, I think the thong is that's intrinsically a funny word and a funny image, isn't it? I mean, I'm going to laugh if I say it now. Thong. Ha! Right. Get it out of my system. So, yeah, but Nina's right. And so I think, well, we're sort of coming on to how wonderfully well you complement each other. I mean, this is an incredible, almost like a little marriage, isn't it? An incestuous marriage, you two, because you're there working together in this incredible way. So, you know, and not fighting at all? No sibling rivalry or tiffs or anything?
No sibling rivalry or fighting. It's actually very easy because there's an age difference between us. I think that if we were closer in age, it would have been more complicated, but I definitely know where I am on the pecking order.
I defer to Nina
and listen to her and her wisdom, and we get a really great thing out of it. And no rivalry at all, only when I've sort of made lunch and then I have to wash it up or something, you know. That's very small.
Yes, that's not a writing rivalry,
no.
Is it?
No, none. No writing rivalry.
No, I mean, when you're in a room together, I mean, you're, let's call you like a comedy team would be, but it's not a comedy team. What's it like in the room together?
It's like ESP. I sit there and I watch her directing and I think, oh, she just said the thing that I wanted to say, or, you know, she better do that. And then it happens. It's because we come from the same parents, so and we think the same, and we actually live in the same flat. So I think we are quite in tune to what our tastes are quite in tune. So we both want the same thing, and she gets it down. And it's really fantastic. I'm incredibly lucky.
Nina, I just wanted to look at the creative process. So Moses is doing the writing, because you write as well, obviously. You're a fantastic playwright as well. I want to have a very quick mention of Wonderful Tiger Country. A play about the National Health Service. Couldn't be more topical. You're right, topical, the pair of you, aren't you, really? These are both awfully topical subjects. But are you there? I mean, you obviously are there during the writing process, because you were just talking about having to justify the song. I thought, what a wonderful phrase, justify the song. But then is Moses there in rehearsal? I mean, lots and lots of directors really hate writers being there in rehearsal, but I'm guessing it's not like that. So we're talking about a long process, are we?
Absolutely. I mean, Mo wrote the play, and I'd come and look over his shoulder, literally over his shoulder in his room, and then go away again. And then he presented me with a draft. And, you know, it's lucky for me that Mo is quite malleable. He's not a rigid person. So in the first draft of the play, it was very much a comedy, because you knew immediately that certain things were the case. They were revealed at the top of the play. And then the comedy was in the audience being in on it, but the half the characters on stage not being in on it. And that, to me, is kind of a farce. And I thought it would be more interesting if Mo veiled it for longer and left it up in the air for longer, because it leaves more, it causes us to ask more questions and go deeper, basically. So I think Mo has got comedic instincts, and, you know, they're brilliant, but it was great to be able to encourage him to sort of bury some of those things and then get a bigger payoff, I thought. So I got involved right at the stage of first drafts, and then we did something which is really fun, which is to read it with friends at the flat and, you know, just get actors in, some of them the wrong ages, you know, just to hear it. And then when it comes to directing, it's lovely to have Mo in the room, because he's not someone who... The nightmare writer to have in your room is someone who wants to plunge in and actually start directing a scene, and then you have embarrassing sort of power struggles on your hands and confused actors and things like that. And Mo would never do that. And in fact, I haven't yet, touch wood, come across a writer that's done that with me. So everyone seems to be quite aware of the etiquette and how difficult it is anyway as a director to control a room. You don't need that. Luckily, Mo and I wanted the same things most of the time. What would happen is that we would talk at the end of a rehearsal day and I'd say, is there anything I haven't been noticing? And he might say, I think that X, you know, they just need to do a bit more of why, and I'd say, oh right, you know. So occasionally there would be something that wouldn't be on my radar that would be bothering Mo, and then next day I'd go in and try and fix it. So that's the way it seemed to work. I'm just thinking if there were any contretemps between us. I think only occasionally Mo, you know, as some writers do, sort of thinks, well, I want the text to be clear, so can't they just sit down and just say the words and sit in a place that everyone can see them, and why don't they do it like that? And I might then actually argue against it and say, look, we can't do that because we've already had one scene in exactly the same blocking. I don't want to do the same thing again. It doesn't make a good stage picture. You know, there'd be all sorts of reasons that I might sort of say, no, they can't do it like that. Then Mo, I remember, said to me, I think that they make, there's a certain fight. He thinks, he was worried that they moved around too much. He said, you know, when you're frozen and in panic, you don't run around the space. You just are locked to the, rooted to the spot. And we had to find a compromise because me as a director thinks, well, you, that could work, someone be frozen with fear. But then the person that's pushing at them, well, where do they go if the person is just rooted to the floor? You know, if someone else is attacking them, you're pretty soon going to have a collision, and then where do you go on from there? So it's, you know, those are the sort of discussions we have.
Who came up with the totally brilliant idea, which I'm sure everybody remarks upon, that your visitor Thomas, when they talk to him, they have the sort of cod Russian accents, actually obviously quite authentic Russian accents, I dare say, speaking English. But between themselves, yes, it could be EastEnders, because they just talk as they would talk. Now, that was so brilliant, because you really got inside them, and you got past... I always hate it on the radio where Germans speak with a German accent to each other. Why on earth would they be doing that? And you don't do that. But, of course, it's because you've got Thomas there that you can have the, you know, the Russian, you know, them stumbling in their English when they're talking to him. It's just brilliant, that. So whose idea was that?
That was my idea, and very quickly I found out that I was not the first person to have had that idea. And now I look back, I can remember watching, wasn't there a TV show called Eurotrash with Jean-Paul Gaultier?
Wonderful Eurotrash, which I loved to bits. My guilty that, pleasure.
Whenever they went to Germany or wherever, the people would have like a sort of mock sort of East End accent, or you know, sound like they're from Manchester, and the translation, and so there was that, and
they liked to use Birmingham when they were talking about the, you know, the length of someone's private parts or something like that, because it just was so pathetic. Pathetic, not pathetic.
So I'm reminded of that, and then someone read the script and said, oh, it's like some TV show, you probably haven't seen it, called Allo Allo, and I haven't seen that, so presumably it's a bit like that. And I bumped into someone when we were at the pub, and he claimed to have written a play where the Russians also spoke in a Russian accent. So I don't think it's totally original idea, but it was when I thought of it.
I'm going to let you have that one, honestly, because it just worked so brilliantly, and it took us straight into it so far. And I also, you needed the outsider eye of Thomas, you know, who's terribly awkward. I mean, in this tiny little flat, and there's three generations of people fighting, and you've got these explosive 18-year-olds. They're terrifying, you know. There's a very scary 18-year-old girl, because I I can't remember what it's like to be 18 or even what my daughter was like at 18, but unpredictable, I would say. Volatile, yeah.
Do you mean Sasha, the daughter, or do you mean the girlfriend, Clara?
No, I actually mean the girlfriend, Clara. I mean, yeah. Sasha, yeah. I mean, Sasha seemed to have lots of reasons for being volatile. Yeah, yeah. Clara was just absolutely frightened the life out of me.
Oh, fantastic. I'll tell her. She'd be thrilled to hear that.
Let's name the actor, please.
She's called Georgia Henshaw, and she's a real find. I'm really excited by her. And she has already been discovered by television, but not by theatre. So we were her theatrical debut. And I think she's... A friend came and saw the play and said, I could watch that girl eat a packet of Pringles. You know, she's really got stage presence and a wonderful, filthy laugh.
She really has. She's just... All the things you said, but the filthy laugh is what tops it.
Yeah, she's adorable. So, yes, she's a firebomb, really, in the play, isn't she? She's, and there's that very audible offstage argument she has with her boyfriend. And we loved her as a kind of... We realised that she could really be the new Russian, you know, the kind of Russian who's dressed to the nines and a different sort of Russian. There are so many different types of Russian, and it was great to have her, you know, as one particular type in the play with the gold wedge trainers and... not cliched, but you know, a particular sort of Russian.
Yeah, well, I know quite a lot of Ukrainians, and that's how the girls look. I mean, you think are they prostitutes or what? No, they're not. That's just the way they dress. Just very cold in the winter for them, but hey. So, should we just talk a bit about the different characters to sort of finish off with? Because you have this, as I said, they're a wonderful cast of characters that they can't help but clash together in the. It's not a melting pot, is it, this flat? I mean, it's a flashpoint flat, isn't it? Because it's so small, this room.
Yes, it's very small, and they're three generations. They all have lived through different things and have different expectations of what life should offer them. And the younger ones want sort of things that the older ones think, frankly, ridiculous. I just used all of the different... people I know at different ages and sort of knock them together. And the old character called Alexander was a real pleasure to write because that was quite an easy, I had an easy blueprint of my cousin in Moscow. And then the rest were sort of my friends and myself in various different forms. And it was nice because very quickly, once you know who they are, you can make them argue, which is a real pleasure.
Should we say who they are? We can go half and half. So the very youngest member of the family is Kolya, who's only about 10 or 11. And he's got a brilliant relationship with his grandfather. And he asks his grandfather about his memories. And, you know, they have a brilliant sort of irreverent bond. You've got Alexander, as Mo said, who's based on our cousin Zhenya. Then the parents, Mo.
And the parents, Ivan and Zhenya, who was named after my cousin because he died when I was writing the play. Oh. And Zhenya is also can be used as a female name. So I sort of put that in for a private reference point.
And that's what Amanda Root's character. Yeah. So that, so it's a great tribute then to him, isn't it? Because she's amazing.
Yeah, she's ace. And then there's Sasha, who's played by Lisa Divany very brilliantly, and she's the daughter. And her brother is played by James Musgrave, and he's called Petya. And then there are two more Russians who are outside the family, who aren't within the family, and they are Natalia and Clara, and one's Ivan's PA, Natalia's Ivan's PA, and the other character, Clara, is Petya's girlfriend.
Well, what's so interesting is, from what you've said, you wouldn't guess that Natalia also is sleeping in this flat. So that's the whole point, that everybody is sleeping in this tiny flat, so on sofas and giving up their beds to each other. It's like Map and Lucia gone mad, isn't it?
Yes, it's like Map and Lucia gone mad. And when I was in Moscow, it was very funny because me and my mum were in one room, and then my cousin was on a sofa, and they had other people staying. So they were all sleeping on sofas and floors. and there's only one tiny bathroom, and it's kind of quite awkward.
And yeah, you put that in the play, all right, don't you?
Yeah, I put that in the play. And I was just made very aware how quickly there, because I don't actually speak Russian, how much I rely on talking and language to interact with other people, and how much I use it to make people laugh and to get along. And when I was there, it was very funny when I wasn't being translated to and for, how hard I found it. And I think that that's what I try to put into the character of Thomas, which is a very weird thing where you want to get along, but you don't have a common language to speak with.
Yeah, well, that really comes over. And I should ask, have these relatives been able to see this play? Would they understand it, and what would they make of it, I wonder?
I think they'd probably hate the swearing, because they're quite religious. I think that, you know, they haven't been able to see it, because it costs quite a lot to come to the UK. But I'm sure they'll read it at some point, and I look forward to hearing what they think of it.
I haven't spoken to you before, Nina, about your amazing father, the poet Craig Raine, and now understanding that Boris Pasternak's blood runs through both your veins as well. So writing, it must be like the acting gene, it must be handed down. Writing and directing, because obviously Nina writes and directs her own shows as well. I suppose I'm asking, you know, about, you know, where does your dad come into all this?
Well, where does he come into all of this? I've for quite a long time, I like pretend that he doesn't really come into it, so I feel like I'm doing something original. But very quickly, I've learned that I am just like a mini him, but a bit shyer. He's a massive influence, and I can't write something and not want to know what he thinks of it. And that can be a help and it can be a hindrance, because quite often he gives advice that is more of an instruction and less of advice, as in you have to do exactly what he says. And I've sort of slowly weaned myself off that. Sort of it's good and it's bad, mainly good.
I asked earlier, Nina, about, you know, having the writer in the room. I've seen Longing, which you directed, but now, of course, I've seen Tiger Country, which you wrote and directed. So is that's not in self-defence, is it? I mean, you must have, but even so, you must have had this vision of the national health.
Well, I did. I was quite scared about directing Tiger Country, especially the first time around, because I had a vague and rather kind of magnificent idea in my head of how the staging would be, these wonderful swirls, but no idea, kind of like, you know, you might have an idea of what you want the lighting to be, but you have no idea how the lighting designer will achieve it. I had that, you know, I want it to look like this, but I don't know how I get there. And with the help of a choreographer, and also you just realise very quickly, once you see people flailing around, you realise what it is that you want by the fact that it's not happening. So I found the way. What was interesting was I was talking to Indira Varma, who played Vashti, the urological registrar, this time around. And she said to me halfway through rehearsals, "It's not like you've written it, it's great." I mean, she meant it as a compliment, that I wasn't directing it like a very precious writer holding on desperately to every, you know, the way that they definitely wanted each line to be. And yeah, I would go, it wasn't a self-conscious thing. I think you've got to come into the room and see what people's ideas are. And then you, as I say, you realise what your taste is for a certain line by people not doing it. And if you really care and they're not coming up with something better themselves, then you might say, "Look, I feel that this is how the line goes." But I went into it quite openly, in a way. And so it didn't feel like I was being a precious writer. It felt much more, you know, especially having left the play for 4 years, I could hardly remember it myself, you know, and my initial instincts and so on.
Well, it's an extraordinary play, and just, you know, just to finish on that, hugely topical, the National Health Service falling apart before our very eyes on stage, and people going into it idealistically. I mean, it's really, to me, it's about one woman having to become more open, human, warm, and less clinical, and that's the one played by Indira Varma. But there's this other, the very young, idealistic young woman doctor, and you watch her ideals falling apart in front of your eyes, and so and I think it's a really clever seesaw. So, and I guess that's what you were trying to say, is
yes,
in
absolutely.
That isn't it?
Thank you. Yes, no, that is what I was trying to do, and And I love the way that those two actresses, Ruth Everett and Indira Varma, do those parts. You know, Ruth manages to make the idealistic person not too wet behind the ears. She has great intelligence, I think, as a performer. And Indira manages to stop the Vashti character becoming too much of a battle axe because she's so charismatic and sexy herself and wonderfully magnetic. So she is very attractive, and that helps counterbalance the kind of the. It means actually that Indira can really play that part incredibly tough and not sentimentalize her at all because she has all these other charms in her artillery, you know.
It's being live streamed. Once it's live streamed, does that mean it's there and people could come back to it and watch it online?
Only, I think, for 72 hours and then it is gone. So it's not for long, I think. I might be wrong, but I think that's the case.
72 hours on the 17th of January. To save the National... watch the National, sorry. To watch this incredible play, Tiger Country. And we've got until, I think, the end of January to catch up here.
We've got till the 31st of January and then it shall be no more.
I just want to wonder if you... One very last question, actually. I just remembered... I mean, just tell us why it's called Don Quixote. It's sort of explained in the play, but...
It's because when the character of Sasha is trying to speak English and explain why she hasn't moved on from this guy that she has kissed 5 years ago, she says, I've got a donkey heart. And what she means is she's got a stubborn heart. So it's a sort of literal translation of what she means to say, because a donkey is a stubborn animal. And as you watch the play, you realise that everybody is actually stubborn in a different way, but they all are pretty stubborn. That's why it's called Don Quixote.
Jolly glad I did ask that, even if it wasn't the very last minute. Moses and Nina. Nina and Moses, thank you so much for talking to me for Theatre Voice.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.